Tuesday's high 33. The numbers now, wind northwest at 10, 21 in Kenosha, 20 in Racine. The wind chill is minus 7. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The year 2024 marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most dramatic events in recent American history, the resignation of our 37th president, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And preceding that dramatic resignation in the late summer was a host of events in seemingly one more dramatic than the one that came before. And those of us who were alive to witness those events will never forget them. I was 14 years old in 1974 and not fully aware of each and every subtle detail of what was going on in our country. But my father and mother were both riveted to the television watching the dramatic hearings that were occurring on Capitol Hill. And I was sitting right there with them, watching these dramatic events unfold. That's one of the reasons why I so welcome a fascinating new book called Watergate's Unexpected Hero, The Life of Peter W. Rodino, Jr. It was Representative Rodino from New Jersey who chaired the House Judiciary Committee that ultimately, of course, voted on several articles of impeachment. And that meant that President Nixon faced trial in the U.S. Senate, and it became increasingly clear that that was a trial he would not survive. And, of course, he did resign. But leading up to that dramatic moment were these fascinating, riveting hearings. And even for those of us a little too young to fully understand everything that was going on, it was captivating television. And Chairman Rodino was a very important figure in all of this. But for as important as he was at that point in time, he is also someone that perhaps is not as vividly remembered or appreciated as he should be. In part, as our author tells us, because he did not go out of his way to capitalize on all of the fame that he had at that moment in time. So it is even more important for the story of Peter Rodino to be properly told. And indeed it is in this new book. As I said, it's titled Watergate's Unexpected Hero, The Life of Peter W. Rodino, Jr. It is written by someone who knew him well and actually worked with him, Dr. Lawrence Spinelli, who worked extensively for more than four decades in various capacities in the U.S. government. And actually, his very first job on Capitol Hill was serving Representative Rodino as his press secretary. And he also served for a time as director of communications for a young senator from Delaware named Joe Biden. Mr. Spinelli served in many different positions. He's served an especially long time at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, where he was the Director of Outreach and Public Affairs. He is also the author of Dry Diplomacy, The United States, Great Britain, and Prohibition. Spinelli was an assistant professor of political science at Drew University and a professorial lecturer at American University. And this book is published by Amplify, again titled Watergate's Unexpected Hero, The Life of Peter W. Rodino, Jr. And Lawrence Spinelli, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I am so excited about this. And again, it's because I was so excited to see your book and to read it and to come to a greater understanding of what I only vaguely understood some 50 years ago. But what I certainly understood was how dramatic these events were and how dramatically our country was about to change. I wonder if anything in particular prompted you to want to write this book.
Well, the main reason was I, as you mentioned, Peter Rodino refused. He was offered in 1974 a lot of money to write a book, to go on the paid lecture circuit, to cash in on his fame. You know, you have to remember, 80 million people watched those hearings. So he went from, you know, obscurity, you know, being only known in New Jersey, to becoming a national hero and recognized. And he was offered a lot of money to cash in on that, and he refused. He said, I'm not going to do it. And when he retired many years later, he toyed with the idea of writing an autobiography. He never did. So as a result of that, he is the only major figure from the Watergate era that doesn't have either a biography or an autobiography. And I think as a result of that, a lot of people have forgotten what he had, what he did. So I felt, and I had said to him before he died in 2005, someday I'm going to write this book because I want people to know about him. And I wanted it to come out in time for this special 50th anniversary to give the full story, not just about Watergate and impeachment, but for everybody to understand the full breadth of Peter Rodino's life and to appreciate his legacy. And, you know, Greg, also, you know, the expression, what's past is prologue. Hopefully we, from the past, we can also find some inspiration to say, here was a moment of great national crisis when somebody stepped up and did the right thing, and hopefully that gives us some encouragement for the future as well.
Right. And, of course, one of the most interesting things, and we'll explore this a little later, is Peter Rodino's attitude about this notion of impeaching a president and where he thought the bar needed to be set in terms of misdeeds that warranted presidential impeachment, and also his devotion to the idea of bipartisanship in such a moment of crisis. And we have a lot to learn from his example, and we'll talk about that. Briefly, I want you to talk about the treasure trove of material and resources upon which you could draw for this wonderful book, including some oral histories that exist, and also some interviews that were done perhaps for that aforementioned autobiography that actually never ended up happening. But just talk about some of this material and how valuable it was to you as you wrote this book.
Well, absolutely. So first of all, ironically, you know, I didn't know this at the time. In 1988, when Peter Rodino retired after 40 years in Congress, I was working for him. I was his press secretary. In fact, he had been in Congress longer than I had been alive at that point. And I helped negotiate. There were a lot of people, a lot of universities interested in his papers, and I negotiated the agreement with Seton Hall University Law School to take his papers, his memorabilia, and they created a professorship in his name, which he then held and became a professor. And he selected Seton Hall because it's located in Newark, New Jersey, which is where Rodino was born, and he represented the city in Congress for that entire 40 years. Well, ironically, I didn't know that I would then be the one benefiting, because when I decided, you know, when and started working on this book, I spent a lot of time up at the archives. And as you mentioned, one of the great treasure troves there is Rodino had done a series of oral recordings in the late 90s, early 2000s, when he was thinking again, maybe he would write an autobiography, which he never did. So there's a lot of, you know, great stories that he told. Of course, my responsibility as a historian is to say these are great stories, but I have to make sure that these are also accurate stories. So in addition to all of that, you know, you have to do all of the research. I spent a lot of time at all the presidential libraries that all the presidents that Rodino had worked with, doing a lot of research there and finding just a wealth of material.
We're speaking with Lawrence Spinelli about his new book, Watergate's unexpected hero, the life of Peter W. Rodino Jr. The book, of course, focuses in great detail on the events of 50 years ago, those dramatic House Judiciary Committee hearings on the impeachment of President Nixon. But the book is a wide-spanning biography that covers every aspect of Mr. Rodino's life and career. We obviously do need to talk about his background, and obviously you felt it to be important because you spend quite a long time and are very thorough in describing his background as the son of an Italian immigrant and growing up under very modest circumstances. In fact, I think we see the word poverty used several times in terms of describing his background. Tell us more about this background and especially the way in which you think it informed the kind of person he grew up to be.
Absolutely. And I appreciate the question, because the reason that in the title of the book is Unexpected Hero is exactly that point. So Rodino had toiled away in the sort of legislative trenches, and then he had only become the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 1973. So literally within less than a year, here he was in charge of the first presidential impeachment since 1868. So people wondered, who is this person? They doubted that he had the ability, you know, to take on such an important task. One newspaper editorial said, well, you know, this is like sending the rookie in a World Series game when all the bases are loaded. And people wondered, could he do it? Because nobody really took the time to look back at his background, which is why I wanted to do that in the book. Because if you understand his history, you would say, you would have felt very comfortable, this man is definitely up to the task. And only later did several people say, well, he was like a latter-day Lincoln, you know, coming out of obscurity at the right moment to steer the country through a crisis. As you mentioned, he was born in Newark, New Jersey, son of Italian immigrants, grew up in Little Italy, tough neighborhood, absolute poverty, lived in a tenement. It was a very tough neighborhood. He was 10 years old. He saw somebody being shot on the street corner. And in this neighborhood, the easiest way to get ahead was either through gambling or bootlegging, organized crime. And the fact that not only did Rodino not go in any of those directions, but followed the straight and narrow because of his father's guidance, because of his own inner sense of morality, but he then ended up being the guy who said, no one is above the law. Defending the law and the Constitution is really says a lot about him.
Right.
But he really struggled because they had no money, and he had to take on a series of all kinds of odd jobs. He worked in a factory that made cigarette lighters. He worked in a railroad station at night to save money to go to law school in the evening. It took him several years to become a lawyer. And all through this, it really demonstrated that he had the patience, the perseverance, the doggedness, determination that, you know, to get ahead. He wanted to do something to help people. And he then began taking care of people in his own community, teaching English, teaching citizenship classes, and that's what eventually led him into politics. He did not wait to be drafted in World War II. He enlisted. He started as a private. He came home as a highly decorated captain, and from that point on got himself into politics.
Mm. I love the line you say early on when you say, surrounded by lawlessness in his ethnic neighborhood, he chose a different path and became a fierce defender of the rule of law. I mean, as you were just saying, he so easily could have followed a drastically different path, and something about his inner integrity caused him to pursue something very differently. Something that is quite intriguing to me, you make only brief mention of it, and this is something you talk about maybe around the time that he enrolled at Dana College, is that he seems to have had some aspirations as a writer, If I remember correctly, he wrote a play and some other things, none of which were ever published. But it's just kind of interesting to think about this being another talent of Peter Rodino.
Yes, he aspired to be a writer. He had written poems. He wrote actually a novel that got lost. He even wrote song lyrics. He thought maybe he could make it as a lyric writer. He had a partner. They tried to sell their songs. None of this, you know, worked. And he also realistically realized that it was not a way, he could not make a living doing that. So he kind of gave that up. But I was going to also add that as his, when I went to work for him as a press secretary, you can appreciate that somebody who was a writer and aspired to be one, he was very demanding on things that I would write for him. And he always used to give me advice to say, Larry, make sure every word counts. And I have to say that was echoing in my head as I was writing this book, particularly when I went back to edit it, before it was finished, to say, okay, make sure every word counts. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I was following his adage. This was important to him.
Mm, I love that. And something else that jumped out at me is that you say that when he made the decision to become a lawyer, that perhaps the paramount reason why he became a lawyer was that he regarded it as the best way for him to serve the most people. And, of course, there are plenty of attorneys who go into the law for that reason and plenty of other attorneys who do not.
But it says a lot about him.
It says a lot about him and his values.
Yes, and that's why, in addition to that, he was always out there for free, giving English classes and then citizenship. Italian Americans in the 1930s were among the lowest. You know, they had the lowest number of Italian Americans were becoming citizens of immigrants that were in America, and that's when he said, you know, we have to change this. So he started with first the English classes and then citizenship classes to help people to become citizens. He thought this was very important. And then, of course, he got involved in politics. He was a supporter of Franklin Roosevelt and a New Dealer, and he went out to promote the New Deal as well.
Hmm. Well, and, of course, you have to love somebody who works their way through law school by working in a factory. So, obviously, Peter Rodino never lost sight of who he was or his roots and why he was doing what he was doing. Well, ultimately, of course, as you say, he went into politics and ultimately is elected to Congress. Explain briefly his road to Capitol Hill in terms of the initial lack of success and then the great success which he ultimately achieved.
Well, the 10th Congressional District, which was Newark and other cities, which is where he lived, was a Republican district, and it was represented by Congressman Fred Hartley of the infamous Taft-Hartley law, an anti-labor law. And so when Rodino said, I'm going to run for Congress, the Democratic Party establishment said, there's no way you're going to win. We're not helping you. We're not giving you any money. You're on your own. Well, they did him a great favor because as a result of that, right from the beginning, he was able to establish his independence. He didn't owe anything to the party bosses, and he set up his own little group of volunteers. He had a ladies' auxiliary, and he got all of his friends involved. He came close to winning. He didn't win the first time. And then in 1948, Fred Hartley retired. Again, the Democrat establishment said, oh, you're not going to win. Rodino ran, and this time he won by 5,000 votes and held that district for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. You tell us that when Peter Rodino came to Washington, he came with an advantage that helped him to stand out from other members of that freshman class. He was something of a, in your words, a political novelty. Explain what made him a political novelty.
Well, the novelty was because he had defeated, or he had taken over the seat of Fred Hartley, who was, probably number one enemy of the Democrats and certainly of organized labor. And so the idea that you now had this liberal Democrat holding the seat that was once held by Fred Hartley really, helped Rodino to stand out. But he did not want to get involved just in those kinds of issues. He had a lot of other things that he was interested in doing and accomplishing. So he really did, you know, pave his own way forward once he got to Capitol Hill.
One of the things I appreciate about your book is that you really lay the groundwork by helping us understand the way Congress operated, and in particular, how the way it operated had just been changed as Mr. Rodino came to Washington, came to the U.S. House of Representatives, and in particular, the whole way in which committees functioned, were selected, had very recently been dramatically changed. So he comes at a point in time when the U.S. House of Representatives and the way it functions had undergone at least something of a transformation. Can you explain to our listeners what I'm talking about?
Yes, there had been a legislative reorganization after World War II. Congress was just so disorganized and just so operating in a very inefficient way, and so they streamlined it. They eliminated a lot of committees. They added some more professional staff, and the idea being this is going to make the place operate more efficiently. What they did not do was to get rid of the seniority system. So when Rodino came as a freshman, this is what he was up against. And he was told, as were all the freshmen, and that included Gerald Ford, who was in the class of 1948 as well, future President Ford, that you are to be seen and not heard. You just, you know, you have to bide your time and keep quiet. Well, Rodino followed that rule for all of about 6 weeks, and he was assigned to the Veterans Affairs Committee. He was a veteran, and the man in charge of the committee, the chairman, was a guy named John Rankin from Mississippi. He was an avowed segregationist, an anti-Semite, and probably one of the worst autocrats in the Congress. And he would have meetings, and he would have roll call votes and ignore whatever happened. He would not let people know what was going on. He really ran the committee like a fiefdom, like a one-man show. And at some point when, you know, Rodino, they were pushing for legislation, they were totally ignored. Rodino was furious, and he went to the floor of the House of Representatives to lodge a complaint. And he talks about remembering how his knees, you know, were shaking. He was really, he knew this was probably going to be the end of his career. You know, you're not supposed to do this. He got up and he sought recognition, and he then said in a speech, he said, you know, we veterans, we went to Europe to fight, you know, for democracy. We didn't want to come home to face undemocratic behavior. This is outrageous. When he was done, there was a spontaneous applause. You're not allowed to applaud on the House of Representatives. All of his colleagues applauded because they all hated John Rankin, and they were glad to see somebody taking him on. But it really, you know, it kind of finished it for Rodino as far as his future in that committee. Luckily for him, in the audience was Emanuel Seller, liberal Democrat from Brooklyn, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jewish American, who hated John Rankin and had been fighting with him forever. He was so impressed with Rodino that the first opening on his Judiciary Committee that should have actually went to somebody else, he gave it to Rodino, and he changed Rodino's life.
Hmm. We're speaking with Lawrence Spinelli about his book, Watergate's Unexpected Hero, The Life of Peter W. Rodino, Jr. He was the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He joined that committee back in 1950 and, of course, was one of the most familiar faces during those dramatic months that led up to the resignation of Richard Nixon. Explain what the House Judiciary Committee was all about at that point in time and the kind of things which they would explore. I think it's really important to talk about this because I think for so many of us, with only kind of a passing understanding of Congress and how it works, we think of this as, oh, that's that committee when you're going to impeach the president. And, of course, it's about so much more than that. And especially at that point in time, it had even a wider sort of, let's call it, jurisdiction than it had had before.
Absolutely. So that the committee then, and to a certain extent even now, among the things that it has within its jurisdiction are constitutional issues, criminal justice, immigration, antitrust, civil rights, all of those issues, large amount of issues. But what was great for Rodino was the two issues that he cared the most about when he arrived in Congress were immigration and civil rights, and both of those issues were in the House Judiciary Committee. So that's what I meant when I said Seller really changed his life when he brought him on that committee, because it really gave Rodino the opportunity, not just the impeachment, because who knew that would ever going to happen, but to really pursue these issues and to find legislative solutions to these issues. And he really worked on all of the major legislation in those areas for the next 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk for a moment about immigration, and of course the issue of immigration has certainly not gone away, and if anything it feels like an even more vexing issue now than it ever has been. But there's actually a long history of difficulty when it comes to the matter of immigration. And I think at one point in your book, you quote somebody as saying that one of the reasons immigration is a difficult issue is in part because it is such a personal issue and emotional issue. And Representative Rodino, of course, really did work hard on the issue of immigration for many, many years, and in particular was interested in abolishing something called the National Origins System. Tell us what was in place at this time that Mr. Rodino was so anxious to change.
Absolutely. So first of all, Greg, I have to tell you that anybody who talks about it and says, well, you know, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, they all came here legally, people need to remember that up until 1924, unless you were Asian, there were no real restrictions on immigration. You got on a boat, you came here, as long as you passed the health inspection at Ellis Island, you came into the country. But in 1924, the United States passed the most restrictive immigration law probably in the world, but certainly in the history of the country. And it was aimed at keeping out certain groups of people. I mean, there's no question about it. They didn't even try to hide that fact. So it set up quotas from countries to say only so many people from these countries, and it was discriminating against Italians, you know, Catholic Italians, and Jews from Southeastern Europe, and had big quotas for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants from England or from Sweden, and they were not coming to the United States anymore. But they did not want any more Italians, any more Jews. And as a result, for Italian Americans, for example, it cut their immigration by over 90%. And it meant that a lot of families, so let's say the first wave of immigrants had come here and they were hoping to bring sisters or brothers or mothers or fathers, after 1924, that became almost impossible. But more importantly, it was considered in the Italian-American community and the Jewish-American community as a stigma, because it was really saying, you are second class, you are less than, we do not want you here. And so from the time Rodino arrived in Congress until 1965, he fought and fought and fought to get rid of this quota system, this immigration system based on national origin. And finally in 1965, they abolished it. President Lyndon Johnson signed the new law on Ellis Island with the Statue of Liberty in the background, and they eliminated that, and that it no longer mattered where you came from, there were not quotas. So this was something very important to him. And then let me add one other thing quickly. because we can talk all day about immigration, but Rodino became one of the leading experts on immigration in the Congress. The last comprehensive immigration reform act that Congress ever passed that ever became law was in 1986, authored by Peter Rodino, signed by Ronald Reagan. They worked together on a compromise to where they, you know, they provided amnesty for undocumented people in the country over a certain time period, and they increased border security, and they created employer sanctions. That was the last time Congress ever came together. That was Peter Rodino's legislation. Mm.
And, of course, he worked tirelessly on civil rights as well. We can read about that in your book. And you mentioned the fact that that iconic photograph that many of us remember of President Johnson signing the Civil Rights Act into law with Martin Luther King right there, we see Peter Rodino, to some extent by accident, right there almost center in the photograph. And it's actually appropriate because although he had been to some extent behind the scenes, he was a critical factor in the ultimate passing of that groundbreaking legislation.
Yes, and all of those civil rights laws, 1964, 1965, fair housing in 1968, voting rights, the extension of the Voting Rights Act, all of those things Rodino was critically involved in and, you know, very much important to him. And the interesting thing is, Greg, you know, he represented, you know, the immigration issue. You can understand he was representing a district that was majority largely African, Italian-American, but there were very few African-Americans in his district. But he believed that in civil rights, deeply believed in civil rights. He had seen how Italians were discriminated against, and so he was determined that he was going to fight against discrimination against everybody, and as a result of which he became one of the champions and lauded by everybody. When I was doing the research, I found many letters from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to Rodino thanking him for his work on various legislation. He was endorsed in his campaigns by A. Philip Randolph, you know, the founder of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the icon of the civil rights movement. So this was very, very important to him, and I think a very important part of his legacy. And I'll just tell you a quick story about that famous iconic photograph. I was in Birmingham, Alabama, and I went to the Civil Rights Museum, and I walked into an exhibit room, and there is that photograph blown up the size of a whole wall. Lyndon Johnson at the table signing, Dr. King right next to Dr. King, Peter Rodino. I'm probably the only one that it was in the museum who recognized Peter Rodino. I came home, he was still alive. I came home that night and I called him up to tell him that. He was so thrilled. I said, there is your legacy right there at that very important event.
Wow. I want to mention that one chapter that caught me by surprise has the title Near Death Experience. It's chapter 7. And I started reading that chapter thinking, my word, I don't remember, I mean, the little I knew about Peter Rodino, I don't remember any dramatic near-death experience. Well, what you're talking about, as I eventually discovered, I hate to sort of spoil the surprise maybe for readers, is politically his near-death experience. And that is the fact that due to an enormous controversy back in New Jersey, Peter Rodino's political career, or certainly at least his congressional career, could have so easily ended before he ever gained his fame in terms of his work on the Judiciary Committee with the impeachment hearings. We don't have a lot of time, I'm afraid, but briefly explain the political peril in which Peter Rodino found himself in the late 1960s.
Well, because of redistricting, as you know, has to happen after every census, he ended up, after a long process, with a changed 10th congressional district that was majority African-American. It was a Democratic, but so the key was the primary, and the belief was that he was not going to win, and he had African-American opponents. But, again, they forgot his great legacy of all the work he had done in civil rights, and A. Philip Randolph provided a key endorsement, as did several members of the Congressional Black Caucus. They came, they campaigned, they helped them. And on that night, I was there that night of that primary. All the TV cameras thought they were going to have a great story about Rodino losing. He not only did he win, but he actually won by a big margin, enough that said, this is going to be his district. People appreciated, you know, that he would represent the district regardless, and he was safe. Over across the Hudson River in Brooklyn, where nobody was paying attention, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Emanuel Seller, lost his primary, so he was out of Congress. So in one fell swoop, Rodino's career was saved, and he was then scheduled in the next Congress to become the chairman of the committee, and within 10 months, he was in charge of the Nixon impeachment inquiry.
Hmm. And you tell us he was the last Democratic member of the 1948 freshman class to assume chairmanship of a committee in the House of Representatives. In your words, for more than two decades, he was the patient protege. And
absolutely.
When he ascends to the chairmanship of the House Judiciary Committee, he has a couple of high priorities. One of them, to diversify what had been a largely all-male, almost completely white committee for decades, and to also decentralize power. And he really acted on both of those priorities.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the people that he recruited to the committee was the great Barbara Jordan, and, you know, from Texas. And, of course, during impeachment, if there was a real star of all of that, it was Barbara Jordan. People didn't know her, and she was just so eloquent. And Rodino was so thrilled that, you know, she was on the committee. And he brought two women and diversified, brought people of color onto the committee. This was very important to him. And decentralized power, because he saw what seniority did, and he didn't want to be like that. That was not, you know, that was not his style.
He was also really anxious as this matter of the potential impeachment of Richard Nixon was approaching. First of all, he seemed to not want that to happen. I mean, he was not chomping at the bit the way many of his fellow Democrats were. You tell us that he actually engaged in some scholarly research on what had unfolded back in 1868 with our 17th president, Andrew Johnson. And one of the things apparently he took away from that study was that, in your way, he was determined to avoid the pervasive partisanship and political maneuvering that that was part of the 1868 impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Tell us the most important ways in which he acted upon these concerns in terms of avoiding blatant partisanship at such an important moment in the country's history.
Well, I think there were two important things that he did. First of all, he hired a professional staff. He didn't use the staff that was already there at the committee. He hired John Doerr, who was a Republican, to lead the impeachment inquiry, and that there were no partisans. And he said to John Doerr, you know, hire staff based on qualifications, no partisans. I want this to be handled in a fair way. The second thing that he did was, because he didn't crave the spotlight, it wasn't his personality, he was happy to, you know, to toil away very quietly, very patiently, and didn't say a whole lot, and to then proceed behind closed doors until they were ready to, they had accumulated evidence, and they were ready to go public with it. And I think he felt that was very important, to give the members of the committee, Democrats and Republicans, the opportunity to see the evidence. And, of course, they had, you know, uncovered these secret tape recordings that Nixon had made at the White House. So they were listening to those. They had a lot of documents that had come out of the grand jury. And to really look at that and take the time to formulate their opinions and let this all sort of gel. And at the end, he did. He succeeded. He, you know, was able to bring six Republicans along with the Democrats voting on those three articles of impeachment.
A lot of us who remember watching those hearings from 50 years ago can remember certain key members. You already mentioned Barbara Jordan. I, for some reason, so vividly remember William Cohen, a Republican from Maine. And maybe it's because he was one of the younger members of that committee, although you tell us in your book that that about half of that committee had served less than 4 years in Congress at the time of those hearings. And it's just kind of amazing to think about so many newcomers to Capitol Hill being part of something so incredibly momentous. But it was 21 Democrats and 17 Republicans who were weighing in on this important matter. And, of course, you also remind us that they were charged with two very important matters. And before even the matter of potential impeachment of President Nixon, it was the matter of confirming Nixon's choice of a successor for the disgraced Spiro Agnew, namely Gerald Ford. That sometimes is not thought about as being nearly so significant, but you spend time talking about those hearings for the confirmation of Vice President Gerald Ford. Explain that significance, which sometimes is lost on the rest of us.
Well, it really plays into this whole moment, Greg. It's hard to imagine what a sense of national crisis there was. So the burglary at the Watergate started out very quiet, but then gained momentum thanks to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein and all these revelations, and then the Senate held hearings. But in the middle of all of this was the revelation that Spiro Agnew, Nixon's vice president, had taken kickbacks when he was the governor of Maryland, and he was going to be indicted. Eventually, he resigned. And for the first time in American history, the 25th Amendment, which had only been approved about 10 years earlier, that provided for filling a vacancy in the vice presidency, was implemented. And it meant that both the House and the Senate had to investigate, confirm the president's nominee. So Nixon nominated Gerald Ford, who was a member of the House of Representatives, and Rodino was in charge in his committee of considering this for the House of Representatives. So this was happening at the same time as then the Nixon impeachment started. So it was really the weight of the world was on him, and you know, and people didn't know who he was, and they wondered. One newspaper editorial said, you know, looking at Rodino, said, well, it's sort of like sending in a rookie pitcher in the World Series when the bases are loaded. People wondered, you know, was he up to the task? Could he do this? They didn't know who he was. But, you know, few reporters did their homework to go back to look at that life that you and I have talked about, that would have said, yes, he was more than prepared. He had really paid his dues, and he had worked in the trenches. He had the personality, the doggedness, the patience, the determination to take on these two responsibilities. But it was clearly a time of grave national crisis.
In fact, it's so interesting that the first chapter of your book begins with the so-called Saturday Night Massacre. And even for those of us alive at the time and who understood, even then, as a 14-year-old, I understood at least something of the gravity of that moment, of the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, with the resignation of Elliot Richardson, the firing of Archibald Cox. But reading your description of it just brings it home again about how in that moment it felt like our country was teetering on the brink of utter anarchy or oblivion. And I'm sure for you as well, who remember those events even more vividly, I'm sure, nevertheless, to return to them and to write about them, I should think that was a deeply emotional experience for you.
It definitely was, and it's funny that how much of it came back to me as I was writing it, things that I forgot. And you're like, oh, yeah, I remember that. I remember where I was. And, of course, I also mentioned in the book that in 1974, in the summer, when Rodino started with the impeachment hearings, were public, I was working in a little town in New Jersey for the summer, and I, you know, one of the newspaper reporters heard that I had been an intern in Peter Rodino's office and came and interviewed me. That's how important Rodino was, that, you know, they were willing to say, oh, let's write a news story about this lowly intern to get his insights on Peter Rodino. But the whole country really was just on edge, And I think that's why he really became this hero, because he really steered the country through these very, very treacherous waters. And that's why anybody that lived through that remembers that. And I will tell you, Greg, even all the way to 1988, before he retired, I would walk through the halls of the Capitol with him, and people would stop him and say, "Thank you so much, Mr. Rodino, or can we have a picture taken with you? We remember what you did. We still remember that." And, you know, there was so many accolades for him when he retired. And then, you know, even when he died in 2005, people definitely remembered that he really was the right person at the right time to steer the ship.
And, of course, in particular, it is so interesting to think about his attitude about impeachment. That is, if not exactly a reluctance, kind of a wariness to launch pell-mell into such an important matter. I mean, for him, the bar of misdeed that warranted impeachment had to be a very high bar, and he was not about to do this in some sort of reckless fashion. And just his measured approach, when it was so tempting to do otherwise, I suppose that's one of the things for which we should be especially grateful.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there were people on the committee and certainly the public, the press, Democrats in the House who were all pushing him, you know, hurry up, hurry up. His great friend was Tip O'Neill, and who was the majority leader, then the later Speaker of the House. And every time Rodino would go to the floor for a vote, Tip O'Neill would grab him and say, "Pete, you got to get this done. You got to get this done." And Rodino would just look at him and say, "I'm doing this at the pace in which we need to do this." And he just, there was nothing. And Tip O'Neill later said, you know, Rodino was right, I was wrong. And that, you know, Rodino's the one that history's going to remember, because he just stood his ground. And again, Greg, that goes back to the measure of the man. If you read the book and see his whole life, you're really not surprised by that, because you just see this doggedness, this determination, this commitment, this strength of character that he had to get over all these other obstacles early in his life. That, yes, when he came to this critical moment, he was able to draw on all of those strengths.
Mm. And again, yes, that quote from Tip O'Neill is so wonderful, when he said, "When the rest of us are all forgotten, he," meaning Peter Rodino, "is the one who will be in the history books." And he is now in a greater way, thanks to your wonderful book. Again, the book is titled Watergate's Unexpected Hero, The Life of Peter W. Rodino, Jr., published by Amplify, the author, Lawrence Spinelli. Lawrence Spinelli, thank you so much for giving the world this really important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. I was pleased and honored to speak with you.
Oh, thank you. What a great interview. I appreciate all the questions, and it's so wonderful to have an opportunity to, you know, get into some of the more details and some of the background of this, so people understand the full breadth of this.
We want to outline for you the morning show schedule for the remainder of the week, since there are going to be some changes. Tomorrow on the morning show, we will be talking about the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra's next concert, which is coming up this weekend. We'll also talk about an upcoming concert featuring the Spirit of Racine Group under a new director. On Wednesday, Curzio Caravati will be talking about his nonprofit Kufi Farm, the Kenosha Urban Farm Institute, which is exploring through research new ways to grow crops and feed the world. Thursday will feature a preview of the next Carthage Christmas Festival, and on Friday, a preview of the University of Wisconsin Parkside's performance of Handel's Messiah coming up this weekend. The morning show is archived on our website, wgtd.org. today, although right now we have completely cloudy skies, the forecast is for partly sunny skies and cold temperatures with a high today of just 30 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 19. Partly sunny tomorrow with a high of 33. Warming to a high of 38 degrees on Wednesday. Back down into the 20s for a daytime high both Thursday and Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.